Hi everyone, Sam here. Thanks for listening to the Policy Dispatch. Before we get on with the show, just a quick word on how you can access the rest of our unmissable and informative journalism on Foresight Climate and Energy. If you'd like to enjoy premium access to this or any of our other podcasts, as well as our in-depth articles, you can. You can try us for 30 days for less than €1 a day, which will give you access to our website and app. Just follow the link in the show notes or go to www.foresightmedia.com to find out more. Join our global community of listeners and readers today to stay informed, entertained, and in the know about all things climate and energy. Welcome to the Policy Dispatch. I'm Sam Morgan, your host and guide through the exciting and fascinating world of the energy transition. In this episode, we're going to be looking at Europe's mighty wind power sector, which is going from strength to strength and providing more clean electricity than ever before. Ambitious targets to put up even more turbines look ever more achievable, and concerning factors like supply chain issues and geopolitics have failed to derail progress. When we think about wind in Europe, it's inevitably the North Sea that first springs to mind. Countries around the body of water have invested billions in wind farms and associated infrastructure, and they plan to invest billions more in the coming years. The basin is going to be one of the major power sources for Europe as we move closer towards net zero and a fully decarbonised electricity system. But it isn't just the North Sea where wind is going to play a massive role. Technological improvements and policy shifts mean that the Atlantic coast, the Mediterranean, the Baltic Sea, the Black Sea, and even the Caspian Sea are going to host wind turbines sooner rather than later. That's great news for countries that aren't located on the North Sea, and also for grid operators in Europe whose networks will have other generation assets to rely upon. Wind Europe CEO Giles Dixon joins me today to explain more about the potential of wind power in far-flung areas, the general state of the sector, and some of the challenges that still need to be addressed. I spoke to Giles ahead of Wind Europe's annual event in Bilbao, which kicks off on the 20th of March. You can find a link in the show notes with more details about that. Before we kick on with the discussion, time for the traditional Policy Dispatch quiz question. This week I'm asking you, the Black Sea does not have any offshore wind farms yet. Romania plans to build its first by 2027. According to estimates, how many gigawatts of wind capacity does Romania and Bulgaria's shared coastline potentially have? Is it A, 25 gigawatts, B, 50 gigawatts, C, 75 gigawatts, or D, 100 gigawatts? Answer as always after the show. So Giles, many thanks for joining me on the show today. It's exciting times for renewables, wind power in particular. Its contribution to the energy transition, I think it's fair to say, in terms of providing green power, is very well established now. Wind power regularly meets the lion's share of electricity demand in a number of countries. The numbers are only just going up. Perhaps just to kick things off, though, a word on the other benefits that the wind sector is providing, maybe, now that we have such a long period of time to actually judge its contribution. You know, is the sector indeed delivering on jobs? Is it helping local communities go through this transition? Is it helping the natural environment? Where do we stand?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's really good to be having this conversation with you. Thank you very much indeed. Look, there are 300,000 people working in wind energy across Europe today. And we need to raise that number to over 500,000 by 2030 if we're going to meet the very ambitious EU goals for the build-out of wind energy. So that's our contribution to jobs. Wind is bringing investments to local communities wherever we build a wind farm. For every single wind turbine that we install, on average, we're generating 13 million euros worth of economic activity. Yeah. And, you know, the onshore wind farms, they are built generally in rural communities, in areas where, you know, there may not be many other investments going on. Yeah, certainly not of a large scale. Okay. It's not just about the investment in the wind farm in the local community. Once the wind farm is operating, the owner of the wind farm is then paying money into the local council every year through some form of tax. land tax or rate or something. And that is bringing revenue directly to the local municipality, and the local citizens are benefiting from that. In addition, many wind farm owners and operators are paying separate money into a community benefit fund. In some instances, if the community say they want to do this, then there are schemes for financial participation from the communities that can actually benefit from the investment that's being made nearby. And it's interesting, the opinion polls show us that in every country in Europe, 75% of people, and it's very consistent, support the continued expansion of onshore wind. And generally, those numbers are even higher when you ask the people who are already living close to a wind farm, because they can see how they're benefiting economically from it.
Mm-hmm. We're just on the cusp of your big event in Bilbao, the annual meeting of Wind Europe and the wind industry.
Yeah.
I understand that you're going to be publishing a new report there as well, exciting piece of literature that goes into the value of the wind sector and wind energy. Maybe you could give us an idea of what that will reveal.
Yeah. You know, for many, many years, people have focused on what are the costs of wind energy? How much does it cost to make wind turbines and build and operate a wind farm? And, you know, we've put a lot of effort into reducing the costs of wind energy. And now it is cheaper in pure economic terms to build new wind farms than it is to build new coal or gas or nuclear-fired power stations. Okay, so that's great. But there's much more to wind than the pure economic cost. It's about the wider societal value that wind energy is bringing. I've talked already about the benefits to local communities who live close to the wind farms. But then there are wider, you know, really strategic benefits in terms of energy security. Yeah, the more wind and solar that we build, the more locally produced energy a country has. And that improves their energy security. It makes them less dependent on energy imports, which are usually fossil fuel imports, from unreliable energy providers. You know, we had this excessive dependence on Russian gas. We are now getting out of that, but we're paying a big price for doing so. Yeah, and the more renewables we can build in Europe, you know, the more we can reduce the risk of having that sort of dependency again, and that's good. So there's that value. There's then a wider value when it comes to nature and biodiversity protection. People don't often think about this, but wind energy is really good because you can always farm inside a wind farm. You can do arable farming, you can do livestock farming, okay? And a lot of farmers do that around wind farms in Europe today. The water footprint of wind energy is close to zero. Okay, that is good for the environment. The wind farm developers, they make a big effort to ensure that they are mitigating against any potentially negative biodiversity impacts that they have. So we don't build wind farms in areas where we know that birds are flying on their migratory routes, for example. We monitor the risk of collisions with birds if necessary. In some places now we're installing equipment on the turbines that will actually stop the turbines operating if there is a risk of collisions. Yep, we have sensors, we have cameras on the turbines that are helping us to do this. So that is very good. And by the way, when it comes to offshore wind, we're working very closely to mitigate the potentially negative biodiversity impacts, but also to maximize the positive biodiversity impacts of offshore wind. When you have an offshore wind farm, there's no bottom trawling going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't do that. It's not safe. And there's no other activity going on the seabed. So actually you have a cleaner marine environment and ecosystem than you would otherwise have had. And that enables us to put artificial reefs on the seabed inside offshore wind farms. We even have fish hotels, a safe place for fish to breed where other sea mammals cannot come in. We also have aquaculture. We are farming oysters in the Netherlands for the first time in 100 years, thanks to offshore wind. You hang cables between the foundations of different turbines. And, you know, you can put lobster pots on there. Mussels and oysters are being farmed as well. And this is all really positive.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic, those stories. I love reading those headlines about the unexpected benefits of renewable energy rollout.
Sure.
I mean, maybe just a question on the last year's results from wind energy, because obviously there was a lot of talk about how renewables was in a bit of trouble because of global supply chain, geopolitics, you name it. How did the data look in the end for 2023? At what point did we get to, and was it a good year, a bad year? What was your
take? Europe actually built a record number of new wind farms last year. In total in the EU, we built 16 gigawatts. Now, that's good. It's not enough for the EU to meet its climate and energy targets for 2030. But the numbers we're going to be building in the coming years will be much higher. We expect now between 2024 and 2030 to be building on average 29 gigawatts every year, which is pretty close to the 33 gigawatts a year that we should be building to meet the EU and climate targets for 2030. So we'll get pretty close to those targets, which is great. Now, why do we think we're going to be building much more in the coming years? Well, three things are happening, or rather have happened. First, we are permitting many more wind farms than we were 2 or 3 years ago, because the EU has brought in new rules to simplify permitting processes, new legally binding deadlines, a requirement on governments to digitalize the permitting processes. There's a new legal principle enshrined in EU law that says that the build out of wind and solar is now a matter of overriding public interest, mm-hmm. which means that if people do appeal against the permits for a new wind farm in the courts, say on grounds of biodiversity impacts, the judges have got to look at the biodiversity impacts, but at the same time, they've also got to look at the legally binding imperative to treat wind and solar as a matter of overriding public interest. So they've got to take a balanced approach to things. And we are now winning court cases in Germany, which are applying these rules already, that we used to be losing. Mm-hmm. And so we have many more permits being awarded now. Germany last year awarded 7.5 gigawatts of new permits for onshore wind farms. Just a few years ago, you know, they were trickling along at 2 gigawatts a year. So that's really ambitious. And we've seen a big increase in the number of permits being issued in Spain, an increase also in France and other countries. The second thing that is really improving is the total volume of new investments. Mm-hmm. Now, there's for many years been a lot of money out there that wants to invest in wind, both onshore and offshore. And one thing that was holding them back in recent years was some uncertainty about the electricity market rules, also a concern that the costs of wind energy were going up, but the revenues of the wind farm operators were not going up as much. So how viable economically were these investments? And those problems we've largely solved now. You know, we have good new clear electricity market rules from the EU, mm-hmm. and governments are now indexing the tariffs that are paid to wind farms in a way they weren't before. So they are reflecting the increase in costs we've had from higher steel, higher commodity prices in the last few years. So those increases have stabilized, the cost increases, the revenues have gone up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's now viable to invest in wind farms again, which is really good. And total investments in 2023 were more than twice what they had been in 2022. So it's much more viable to invest than it had been previously. Third thing that is happening, which is positive, is that governments have big ambitions for the build-out of wind, and they are starting to walk the talk, matching their ambitions with big auctions. So last year, Europe auctioned in total 26 gigawatts of new wind farms. That was a record amount by some distance. And that 26 gigawatts broke down 50-50 onshore wind and offshore wind. At the same time, the supply chain, which had been struggling because of the mismatch between costs and revenues that we'd had in the two previous years. That is now coming back to profit, which is extremely encouraging. And the supply chain is building new factories to help meet this growing demand for wind energy. So we are feeling much more confident today than we were 12 months ago.
Hi, everyone. Sam here. Thanks for listening to the Policy Dispatch. Before we get on with the show, just a quick word on how you can access the rest of our unmissable and informative journalism on Foresight Climate and Energy. If you'd like to enjoy premium access to this or any of our other podcasts, as well as our in-depth articles, you can. You can try us for 30 days for less than €1 a day, which will give you access to our website and app. Just follow the link in the show notes or go to www.foresightmedia.com to find out more. Join our global community of listeners and readers today to stay informed, entertained, and in the know about all things climate and energy.
It's fascinating to hear especially about the permitting issue, about, you know, having followed this, whether or not there was this idea of what the EU was saying was just talk or it was going to be something tangible. So to actually hear that it's having these results in the courts as well is very interesting.
I mean, it's delivering real benefits and real improvement in permitting volumes, yeah.
Excellent. I mean, I was going to ask you about, because we obviously talk a lot about the North Sea being the battery of Europe when it comes to offshore wind, lots of developments there with interconnectors, wind farms, even hybrid interconnectors being planned now. Just kind of looking away to other markets in Europe for offshore, you're going to be in Bilbao for your summit. Mm-hmm. If we sort of talk a bit about maybe what's happening on the Atlantic coast, and mm-hmm. is there anything happening there that's of interest, and technological developments, maybe permitting, grid connections, how does it look there?
Lots of interesting things are happening. So offshore wind up until now in Europe has been in very large part a North Sea thing. Okay. Yes, there have been offshore wind farms built in the Baltic Sea as well, and there will continue to be growth there. There will still be growth, huge growth in the North Sea, of course. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But now we are seeing offshore wind farms being developed in the Atlantic as well. So France will announce the results this year of the world's first tender for a large-scale floating offshore wind farm off the south coast of Brittany, 250 megawatts. What's driving the development of offshore wind in the Atlantic is, to a large extent, the development, the coming of age of floating wind technology. Now, nearly all of the offshore wind we have in Europe today is what we call bottom-fixed offshore wind. The foundations are physically connected to the seabed. With floating wind, it's different. You have a floating structure on the surface, and then there are three mooring cables that connect to anchors on the seabed. Mm-hmm. Now, the bottom fixed offshore wind, you can only do it when the sea is up to 60 meters deep. Mm-hmm. When the sea is deeper than 60 meters, you need to go to floating. Mm-hmm. Now, the Atlantic is deeper than the North Sea and the Baltic Sea. Mm-hmm. The Mediterranean is also deeper. But floating wind technology has now come of age. We have four small floating wind farms in operation in Europe today, two in Scotland, one in Norway, one in Portugal, and they are all working extremely well. Mm-hmm. Total capacity is about 170 megawatts of those four floating wind farms we have today. And now governments around the Atlantic and the Mediterranean are all saying, right, we can do offshore wind now because floating technology is available. So Spain want to have up to 3 gigawatts of it by 2030. France have plans. Italy and Greece have plans. Ireland have major plans. The UK itself has major plans for floating wind as well. And this is really changing the geography and the politics around offshore wind. It's becoming a whole Europe affair rather than just a North Sea and Baltic Sea affair.
And when you see developments happening in the Atlantic then, whether or not it's France or Spain making these investments into these projects, do you get this trickle-down effect then where you suddenly have Mediterranean countries thinking, oh, this technology is finally viable, we can start thinking about doing tenders and projects and grid connections for this kind of thing? Is that the kind of timeline we're looking at?
So France are doing tenders already for floating, as I said. Spain want to start their first auction this year, if they can. Italy has a lot of projects being developed, and the government are studying an auction program, and we expect some announcements there soon. Greece are quite advanced in their plans for auctions. They've identified the sites where they want to have floating wind farms, and they're starting now to select the consortia that will be interested in developing those sites. So essentially, you know, all the countries around the Mediterranean in Europe are now getting into this, which is very positive.
They're raring to go then. They're just waiting for the...
Yeah, very much so.
You mentioned the Baltic as well. Obviously, it doesn't have the same problem as the Med. It's a lot shallower. You know, you can walk on your knees for a lot of it, can't you? What are the real sort of hurdles there to preventing that being the new North Sea in a way at the moment? Is it things like grid connections and countries around the coast being less adept or experienced in running renewable energy auctions? What are the problems we need to solve there to really unlock the potential?
Yeah, let's just look at the numbers first of all. So the governments around the North Sea together have said, and their heads of government all came together last year in Ostend in Belgium to make these commitments. They said, we want to have 120 gigawatts by 2030. The eight governments around the Baltic Sea have said, we want to have 23 gigawatts by 2030. They've got around 3 or 4 gigawatts today, okay? And it's all eight countries around the Baltic Sea who want to do this. Of course, two of those eight are already busy doing offshore wind in the North Sea, Denmark and Germany, but they have projects in the Baltic Sea as well. And there are not really particular additional challenges to doing offshore wind in the Baltic Sea that you don't have in the North Sea. All the countries want to do it, which is great. There is one country which is slower than others in actually supporting the development of offshore wind in the Baltic Sea, and that is Sweden. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of projects that developers want to take forward, and there are some permits being awarded, but the Swedish government is not offering any support in terms of an auction, any support with the financing. They're not even offering to support on the grid connections as well. So it may be slower coming to fruition in Sweden than elsewhere, but there's activity in all the other Baltic states and Baltic countries, rather. And last year, we had the first final investment decision taken for an offshore wind farm in Poland. You know, they have a goal to have 5 gigawatts or more of offshore wind by 2030. And, you know, they're starting to make real progress towards that now.
Just the point about Sweden, is that just because they're concentrating on other renewable energy sources or non-renewable energy sources, as it may be, or is it just that priority is not to look at offshore at the moment? What's the story there?
So they have fantastic onshore wind. And they are building out their onshore wind rapidly at a rate of about 2 gigawatts every year at the moment. Yeah, you know, the geography supports that. They have fantastic wind speeds. Great. You might say, you know, how far does Sweden actually need the offshore wind? We judge that they do, and so do most people. Yeah. And it adds to the greater development of wider European capacity for offshore wind. And there's a lot of appetite among industry for offshore wind here, whether it's for, you know, electrons to run their factories or for renewable hydrogen to decarbonize their factories. Now, you have the additional political issue in Sweden, which is that the current government relies on the votes in Parliament of the Sweden Democrats. The Sweden Democrats do not like wind energy. Yeah, and that makes it quite difficult for the current Swedish government to be seen to be doing or sometimes even saying things that are positive about offshore wind, okay? And there are political forces in Sweden that are saying, no, actually, our main focus should be nuclear. The Swedish government will often say, well, actually, you know, yeah, we want more nuclear, more onshore wind and more offshore wind. They might say that. They may not say it very loudly. And they certainly feel somewhat inhibited when it comes to actually making things happen on offshore wind.
That's three of the seas we've talked about. One more, I suppose. We've got the Black Sea as well. Obviously, two EU countries have borders there, Romania and Bulgaria. Is that a completely untapped market at the moment, or is there exciting things happening there as well?
So there's no offshore wind in the Black Sea today. It has been mapped. Studies have been written, extensive studies, including by the World Bank, and there is very good potential in both the two countries that you mentioned. And there's real interest in both countries. There are draft laws for offshore wind in both parliaments, in Romania and Bulgaria, more advanced in Romania. There are some specific projects on the Romanian side that have been identified and some developers that seem interested in pursuing them. So it will come, there is another sea slightly further afield, the Caspian Sea, where there is a government, Azerbaijan, that is very keen to build offshore wind. They want to have 7 gigawatts or more, and their plan is to export the energy that those offshore wind farms would generate to Europe via a new green energy corridor, a new cable that would be built under the Caucasus and then through the Black Sea. And this is a project which the European Union strongly supports. There's been a memorandum of understanding signed between the governments of Azerbaijan, Georgia, Romania, and Hungary on this, with the support of the European Commission, a very interesting project. Of course, Azerbaijan is already bringing a lot of energy to Europe through the Southern Gas Corridor and has helped Europe a lot in the diversification away from Russian gas. So the EU sees Azerbaijan as a very reliable energy partner and is keen to replicate on offshore wind the very successful model now of importing gas to Europe from the Caspian.
I was talking to someone at Ørsted a while ago, and they were saying about the importance of hybrid interconnector projects going forward for the wind sector. And I wondered whether or not, because you have this blank slate in the Black Sea at the moment with, like you said, no offshore wind farms there, if we're building this infrastructure there between the Caucasus and Europe, does this become a time where you say, right, we need to be really advanced with this and think about connecting through wind farms that we haven't built yet? Do we need to be really ambitious with this kind of project rather than just replicating what's been done in other places?
Okay, let's just pause on these hybrid projects for a moment and just make sure everybody understands, you know, what we're talking about. All but one of the offshore wind farms we have in Europe today have one single grid connection back to the mother country, what we call a radial connection. Yes. Okay. There is one exception to that, which is a wind farm in the Baltic Sea, which has a cable to Germany and a cable to Denmark. It's called Kriegers Flak and is operated by Vattenfall. Now, that is an example of a hybrid offshore wind farm. That is to say, an offshore wind farm which has a grid connection that is something other than just a single cable back to the mother country. Okay. Now, there are various configurations of these hybrid offshore wind farms that you could have. You could build an offshore wind farm off the coast of the Netherlands. You could build one off the coast of England, and you could connect them with a cable. Yeah. So that both the Dutch and the British wind farms could actually, you know, be selling their electrons in either country. They could be flowing in either direction. That then becomes a de facto interconnector between the Netherlands and the UK. Okay. Now, under EU law, when you have a de facto interconnector or any cable between two countries, you have to ensure that there's always 70% capacity availability at either end of that interconnector. Yeah. And one concern for offshore wind farm developers that have looked at this idea of having hybrid offshore wind farms is, okay, you know, we can produce our electrons, but are they going to be squeezed out? Yeah, by the system operators who have to ensure this 70% system availability at either end. Yeah, will we be able to actually get our electrons into these cables that are going to be built? Now, the European Union has largely solved that problem now with something in its latest electricity regulation, which guarantees that the electrons coming out of these hybrid offshore wind farms would always get into the grid. Okay, to put it in very simple terms. So that's good. But we don't quite know what which market they would be then selling into out of the two, or even, you know, out of the three, if there's a cable to a third country. What would the rules be there? Therefore, what would the revenues be? There's uncertainty, and there's a feeling there's still of a bit of a price risk there. And so today it's quite difficult for the offshore wind farm developers to invest in these hybrid configurations. Everybody agrees that they make sense because they enable you to pool your generation and transmission infrastructure. That saves money. It saves space in the sea as well. And of course, it improves energy flows between countries. And that's good. The wind is always blowing somewhere in Europe. We've got to get it from wherever it's blowing to wherever it's needed at any point in time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it helps liquidity in electricity markets as well if you've got more electricity flows between countries. So these hybrid offshore wind farms will come. There is a study that the transmission system operators have just brought out with the blessing of the European Commission that says by 2050, these hybrids will probably be 15% of all of the offshore wind farms we have in Europe. 15%. Yeah. I mean, there are other configurations of these hybrids. You could have a sort of hub and spoke mm-hmm. arrangement in the North Sea where you've got one central platform and the offshore wind farms round about it. They connect in with an AC cable and then you have a DC cable from the central platform back to the mother country. You could call that a hybrid offshore wind farm, for example. Yeah. Various different models. They will play a role, but the focus continues to be and will continue to be the offshore wind farms with a radial grid connection.
Let me just go back to the point about Azerbaijan when they develop wind power. Obviously, Azerbaijan is hosting COP29 later this year, very keen to downplay the idea that it is just a fossil fuel producer. So obviously, this is where wind energy comes into it. Do you think that then this could be a real win or success story leading into that summit where you would be able to show this hopefully former fossil fuel focused country making this transition towards something green, future leaning, and wind power to be the vector to kind of bring that about?
Very much so. The Azeri government are already saying, look, we are strongly committed to the build out of renewables. They have big plans for wind, as we've discussed, and for solar PV as well. And they're talking openly about their plans for offshore wind and the Black Sea cable. No, it won't happen by the time of the COP, of course, yes. But in terms of the firm plans, yeah, it could well be something extremely credible that the Azerbaijan government hold up at the time of the COP to show they are, you know, deadly serious about the build-out of renewables.
This is 2024, obviously. We're a little bit into it already. Do you expect this year to be like a vintage year for wind power and that? We've obviously hinted towards it a little bit during the discussion, but is this really going to be the trigger point where any kind of doubt about wind power's viability and future turbocharged nature are going to be completely dispelled? And by the time we get to 2025, it's all systems go?
Yeah, we don't really do vintage years, nor do we do turbocharging. We do steady expansion. Yeah. Okay. And we expect to build at least as many new wind farms in Europe this year as we built last year. We will start to see significant increases in the annual build-out rates next year. We expect to get well above 20 gigawatts next year, and that number will then rise into 26, 27. And we expect to average, as I said earlier, between 2024 and 2030, annual average build-out of 29 gigawatts a year in the European Union. That's onshore and offshore combined, and that compares to the 16 gigawatts that we built last year.
Giles, really fascinating stuff. It was really interesting to hear about how the recent sort of raft of EU policymaking has really already had an effect on things like permitting and that kind of thing. And also to hear more about the lesser known, far-flung areas where wind is starting to have an impact as well, away from the North Sea, which obviously will remain important. But to hear about things like the Caspian, like the Black Sea, the geography nerd in me has really enjoyed this discussion. So really thank you for joining me on this episode.
I've enjoyed it greatly too. Pleasure talking to you.
Many thanks for listening to today's episode. I found the discussion with Giles really interesting. Hearing more about how offshore wind power is not exclusive to Northern Europe was fascinating, and I think important to bear in mind as the energy transition continues to gather pace. Southern and Eastern Europe has a lot of potential, and it's starting to be tapped now. It's an exciting time for the sector. Remember to check the link in the show notes for more details about Wind Europe's Bilbao event and the report that Giles and I mentioned during the discussion. Before I go, time to give you the answer to the quiz question. I asked you at the top of the show, the Black Sea doesn't have any wind power at the moment. How much potential capacity does Bulgaria and Romania's shared coastline have according to estimates? Is it 25, 50, 75 or 100 gigawatts? The correct answer is 100 gigawatts. That's mighty potential, considering that Romania and Bulgaria's combined power demand by 2030 is estimated to be around the 20 terawatt hour mark. The two countries are going to need as much clean energy as they can get their hands on. That's it for this episode. Please comment down in the contribution section with any thoughts you had on the topic. We always welcome a vibrant discussion about these topics. Members can join this conversation whenever they like. To any non-subscribers listening, we'd love to have you join our growing community. It's never been easier or more rewarding to climb aboard. To get you started, we're even offering you a month's free access, no strings attached. Simply head to foresightmedia.com/onboarding/policydispatch to claim your free trial. Until next time, thanks for listening. I'll be back to guide you through another facet of the energy transition very soon.